morning, everybody. Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors is now in session. Ms. Lawson, would you lead us in the flag salute, please?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Chaplain Bradley, please.
Gracious Heavenly Father, we thank you for opportunity to be part of the public and the serving of our community. We're grateful for each one who serves on the board. Thank you for their attention to detail. Every item on this agenda is something that is important to someone here today. And we are grateful for our county supervisors and their diligence. Thank you for the public who participate. Father, we pray for the extended peace in the Middle East as things are moving in that direction. May we find a way to live peacefully with everyone around us. May we encourage one another to love and to respect and be part of a community that moves forward. Thank you for this opportunity. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Alrighty, so real quick, the board will be convening today as the Siskiyou County Flood Control and Water Conservation District, Siskiyou Power Authority, and In-Home Supportive Services Public Authority, and receives no additional compensation. Supervisor Valenzuela?
I'm here.
Supervisor Hupp?
Present.
Supervisor Harris?
Present.
Supervisor Cobbsett?
Here.
And Supervisor Oakley?
Present.
Thank you much.
Presentations from the public, item four. This time slot is for information from the public. No action or discussion will be conducted on matters presented at this time. You will be allowed 3 minutes for your presentation. Written comments can be presented if so desired by providing a minimum of 7 copies to the clerk. When addressing the board, please state your name for the record prior to providing your comments. Please address the board as a whole through the chair. Comments should be limited to matters within the jurisdiction of the board. Can I call Woody, please? I'm sorry, I can't pronounce your last name. You'll fix that.
Yes. Hi, my name is Woody Wickham. I live on Copco Road, and I was in here a couple months ago complaining about the conditions of the road. And since then, you guys have sent your crews out and did an amazing job. I can't say enough how pleased we are. And my wife Dory said, make sure you tell them I said thank you too. So God bless each and every one of you. Thank you, Ray, for talking to me after I was in here. You guys did a stellar job. I know it's not complete, but man, it's perfect the way it is, and I'm so grateful. And I know you guys probably hear more complaints than you do attaboys, but you guys did a stellar job, so thank you kindly. God bless you.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you for that comment, but our public works director is right there who deserves the allocates right there.
Thank you. We don't ever hear enough attaboys, so that's nice. Michael Harris, please.
Good morning, Chair, Supervisors. My name is Michael Harris. I'm an Environmental Program Manager with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Klamath Watershed Program. And I want to give an update on the Big Springs property, kind of let you guys know what's going on there right now. I know you guys have an agenda item later in terms of property transfer, so I just want to give you guys an update on what's going on ours. And I also want to be, I only have 3 minutes, so I'm going to come back and give you guys a more formal presentation if you're interested in that. So the primary reason that the department bought the property was for the cold water resources in Big and Little Springs. We've always used our water sparingly, and starting 3 years ago, we've almost completely stopped using irrigation water. At the beginning of the curtailments, the Shasta producers wrote us a letter saying that that was where they would like to see the water go and to have us actually curtail before any of the junior rights. So we've done that for the last 3 years. And this cold water is directly adding to the recovery of salmonids in the watershed and assisting with other regulatory requirements through the 1707. Of course, that changes the landscape in terms of land use. So in terms of vegetation and invasive species, last year the department completed a $1 million-plus contract for juniper removal on Big Springs using a local contractor. This year, the department did prescribe burning the CAL FIRE just 2 weeks ago, totaling 180 acres, and are planning to do more. The existing grazing lease is active through the 2026 grazing season, so we still have cattle on the property, and we will continue to do so and have another lease when that one expires. We are continuing to disc previously planted areas to control weeds and plant wildlife forage such as rye, and are switching to native-based seed pollinator species mix to actually increase wildlife habitat value. And we're doing planting of native shrubs on the property to bring back a more natural habitat. In terms of wildlife monitoring, we're conducting avian surveys in the spring and the fall. These include acoustic recording units as well as point counts. Thus far, we've identified 62 specific species on the property. We're continuing to do our juvenile monitoring snorkel assessments in the waters of the Big Springs Ranch, Big Springs Creek, and the Shasta River. In terms of water quality and flow monitoring, we're continuing to deploy water temperature probes in all the waters that we manage. We have them in the Big Springs Creek, Shasta River, Little Springs Creek, and we're also doing flow monitoring during low flow periods. And this information continues to existing data sets and allows for assessment for oversummering habitat conditions on the ranch for some monitors. I know public access is a big topic. 2 years ago, we installed 3 parking areas and visitor locations that we're installing wildlife signs on, so when it opens to the public, we're ready to have them. We've been improving roads out there to stop erosion and make access easier and safer. We're actually having our first event out there this week. Big Springs Ranch is open this week for numerous schools to come participate in spawning and viewing and several other biological-related activities. We have fish dissection, nature journaling. We actually have a rotary screw trap out there that kids can actually go up. We have rubber fish, and they'll actually take measurements and learn how to actually monitor for juvenile fish. So we have a lot, and then a salmon life cycle. And then this weekend, we're opening it up to the public in partnership with the community to actually have similar activities and view spawning. And this is an activity that we're doing with the CalTrap. In terms of county interactions, you know, we have our road of entry with the county for sigma monitoring. We also are allowing the county sigma process to install 6 wells, and was just recently asked if we could pull water. You guys could pull water samples for testing as well, and of course you can. The recorders from our wildlife program, not only to capture birds out there, but we're actually utilizing them to see if we can actually take some of the pheasants from your airport area and transfer them over to the Big Springs Wildlife Area. We have multiple restoration projects going on right now that will increase cold water from Little and Big Springs, so it will add to that overall cumulative value of the water that comes out of there. We've paid for gauging stations on the property, and we're working to improve the accuracy on them, knowing that they're not always the most accurate. So I think in closing, you know, the Big Springs property and CDFW, I think we are good neighbors. We're trying to move forward on that property in a very proactive manner. Just for clarity to the board, the department does not want any more lands transferred to the department in the Shasta or Scott River watersheds. And at the time of the transfer, I know there's always a concern about the tax base. And during the part of the transfer, when it was transferred from TNC to the department, that transaction provided the Siskiyou County over $350,000. So, once again, willing to come back and give a more formal presentation. Wildlife's doing dramatically well out there, and I have a lot more things I can talk about and show pictures of. So always willing to come back and give you guys an update if anybody's interested. Thank you.
We'd love to have you back.
Yeah, okay. We're interested.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I love your new building.
Yeah.
So do we. Thanks. Amy Campbell, please.
Good morning. My name's Amy Campbell. I'm a senior project director for the Nature Conservancy, and I'm here to speak to the consent agenda item 5B. We were recently made aware of a potential draft opposition letter by the board against a property that TNC is interested in buying called Marble Peaks Ranch in Scott Valley. And I wanted to just come to the board to make sure that you have the full context before you make the decision. The Nature Conservancy doesn't want to create division, but we want to build transparency around what the project actually entails, and we're here to listen, understand, and clarify any concerns you might have. So to the first concern in your draft letter, the concern about loss of property tax revenue, your letter states that Siskiyou County has over 60% of public lands, which limits your ability to generate revenue from taxes. And we recognize the importance that property tax revenue has on keeping our county funded. And because of that, TNC made a commitment to this board in 2005 that we would continue to pay property taxes on properties we own in Siskiyou County, even though as a nonprofit organization we legally don't have to. And we've kept that commitment. Evidence even this 2025 tax year, we just made a payment of $70,000 of property taxes for the properties we own here in the county. Specifically to the property in question on the agenda, TNC remains committed to pay property taxes on Marble Peaks Ranch as long as we own it. Secondly, there was a concern in the letter about stewardship and management of the properties as it relates to weed and wildfire mitigation. In 2023, TNC hired a full-time stewardship manager who is overseeing the management of our properties. And in that, this past couple years, she's paid particularly close attention to the control of noxious weeds on our properties. And her husband have spent many hours pulling weeds along county roads and on the properties to minimize any spread. We're going to maintain that commitment for Marble Peaks Ranch and other properties. Secondly, we, TNC, have worked really closely with the Scott River Watershed Council and the French Creek Watershed Community to support planning for a watershed scale fuels reduction plan in French Creek. The Watershed Council is currently actively writing grants for that, and we are totally in support and assisting as we can. Additionally, we continue to lease our lands to local ranchers who irrigate and graze our property, and we plan on taking the same approach for Marble Peaks Ranch while we plan for the restoration and water management changes on the property. And I think more importantly, TNC isn't doing this planning work alone. We lean heavily on local partners and technical expertise to advise us on the development of property management plans, and we'll be doing the same for Marble Peaks Ranch. Partners we've engaged with thus far include the Watershed Council in the Scott Valley, state resource agencies, Klamath Basin tribes, representatives from Siskiyou County's Natural Resource and Agricultural Departments, Larry Walker and Associates, Wairika's UC Cooperative Extension Office, and the Scott and Shasta Watermaster District, and more. So last year, I had the privilege of touring Supervisor Kobseff around our Parks Creek Ranch property, and would encourage board and staff to join us and visit our lands on any other future properties. Please just let me know. And we hope that the board will consider delaying or revising this letter to allow for further discussion. We remain committed to work with the county in good faith and to protect the natural resources that makes our place and our county so special. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Grace Bennett.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Grace Bennett, and I live here in Warren. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about our past event that was just happened the end of September at the museum. And as you all know, that's one of my pet heart projects. And we had our family friend day this year, and it was bigger than ever. We had 700, and I know Ed likes numbers, so this is special for Ed. We had 782 people show up, and below are the groups of families and where they came from. So it was really, really well attended by a lot of people. And we were open from 9 till 4, and constant people all day long. It's a wonderful event. And it really highlights our museum. The museum was open free of charge for that day. My other thing is that we recently acquired Bob Rice's collection of information and some new equipment, and we're about halfway through scanning all of those documents, and I still have a couple of boxes to go through. So it's a labor of love, and to find all of the maps and the information that he has is just totally amazing. And once we're finished, we will have an index that anybody that wants to come in and see what has been scanned, and if they want to see the hard copy, they'll be able to do that too. We also have a lot of the maps that he produced, and we have, like you've seen in the stores where they have the flip map for the flip charts for posters and things. We bought some of those, and we're going to have the maps sized for those. And so if you need to see a map, you'll be able to come in and flip through those, and they'll be protected. So that's part of our continuing effort to work with the at the museum. museums. And the real reason I'm here today is to talk about the baseball field. It's on the consent agenda and for a new 5-year lease. Every year we do a project out there. This last year we bought a new hood and a fan for the snack shack, which was greatly needed. And this next year we're going to try to get a cover for our batting cages. And we've put in the power so that they will be lighted. And we'll work on that project for the next year. So I appreciate your continuing support for both of these things. And we'll keep working on keeping kids busy. So that's good. Thank you.
Congratulations on your new great-grandchild.
Oh, he is wonderful.
Thank you, Grace. Do we have any other comments in the room? Any online?
Showing none online.
Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to consent agenda. Any items to pull?
Pull item B.
Item B. We have wishes for the board for the rest.
Move to approve the balance of the consent agenda minus B.
Second.
Item Supervisor Valenzuela?
Yes.
Supervisor Help?
Aye.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
Supervisor Kopstedt?
Aye.
Supervisor Okrin?
Aye. Item B.
Yeah, just quickly, I just prefer a vote on this, but you know, when I look at the item, there's no really discussion on why this comes about. So I always struggle with these. You know, the Nature Conservancy in my mind has always done what they've said they're going to do. We use Big Springs Ranch and how we've come along that way. And to me, it's in theory should be a positive for the community, including the ranching community. So I mean, again, without getting into too much of it, just ask for a roll call vote.
Okay. Any more? That's it. Alrighty. So who's making the motion to approve? Thank you.
Not to approve. I just
not to approve.
No.
Well,
someone else got to make approval.
I need a motion.
I'll make the motion
to approve.
To approve the letter, yes.
Approve the letter of opposition. Okay.
Correct.
And is there a second?
That was Ray.
Thank you. Alrighty, Supervisor Valenzuela.
Before we take a vote, we have a further discussion, please. I think my biggest concern for supporting this letter will be that I know I was up on the, I'll call it the old Parker Ranch with Amy, and at that time it was indicated that there would be no further purchases of land by Nature Conservancy in the future, that you did not have the capacity to manage even what you had on hand. And even though the Big Springs Ranch, Nature Conservancy was not able to bear out their project there. That was to be able to show that ag and fish could coexist. Unbeknownst to everyone, you know, the Department of Fish and Wildlife had a clause in there to take over the water right after 5 years. And subsequently, it became under the ownership of the state, which, yes, the state forced Nature Conservancy to cough up $350,000 as a one-time offset to property tax future. But that did come off the tax roll. With all of the good things that, whether it's Nature Conservancy or whatever other agency comes in under the WCB grant funding program to purchase land or easements, I have yet to see any relief to the ag community on the regulatory front. The Big Springs Ranch was supposed to be the mother lode for salmon, and that's why it was purchased. And it was to relieve the regulatory environment to the whole system. Dam removal was supposed to relieve the regulatory system on the Shasta and the Scott, and yet it's produced more regulations. We were confronted with an e-reg on a false drought on these systems that curtailed flows. And now we have AB 263 that made those basically law until the permanent flows are established. When I see bearing of fruit for the state and I'll say nonprofit organizations purchasing taxable land in Siskiyou County. Until there's regulatory relief to these systems that we've been fighting for 30 years, then I'll have a consideration for continued purchase of these properties. But as it is, 12% of Siskiyou County is a taxable base. That's it. And I know, you know, well, I can go on. The Point Reyes fiasco with 12 dairies going down with Nature Conservancy involved with that is another thing that tells me that, you know, ag is not getting relief from the proposed good work that Nature Conservancy is supposed to be doing with these lands. So I support this letter. I do not support, and I have taken, out of any board member here, I have taken more heat on the purchase of the Big Springs Ranch from the community and had stood up for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, stood up for the Nature Conservancy to let them have a shot at it. And yet it's a continual thing, again, that there is no regulatory relief to the Scott and Shasta systems that has borne fruit from the purchase of these properties. So I support this letter. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I wasn't going to really say much, but I will. Unlike other board members, I've worked with TNC on the East Coast and the West Coast in professional settings. I find TNC on the West Coast to be very different in the purchases of land and taking it out of production. On the East Coast, it's more a relationship with research and public lands work, habitat conservation plans that are paid for, but the ownership is retained by the property owner. There's no doubt there's some good work going on with the fuels reduction in French Creek. Some of the other things that are happening out there, but that doesn't cover up the pieces that I and a lot of my constituents who call me are a little unnerved about. Number one, most of my constituents believe it violates the Scottsdale Area Plan. From the standpoint that it, in perpetuity, takes ag land out of full production. That was not the intent of the Scottsdale Area Plan. Personal issue with me is under state regulation, before the WCB puts anything in escrow, they're supposed to coordinate with the county. We never do. We never learn about these until these properties are in escrow. And then the 1707, that's always known in these properties, the devaluing of the property through the dewatering that takes place on these properties, in perpetuity, reduces the land value and also the ability of that land to produce for both the economy and for the human food source in our nation. That's not sustainable. And it's all done in the essence of fish. Yet, if you look at it from a global, not even global, but a more regional hydrologic standpoint, the dewatering of those properties is actually leading to the diminishment of low flows in the fall, which is the opposite of what we're trying to do with our approved SGMA plan and our groundwater management plan. So that's why I support this letter.
Any other comments?
Just real quick, I first of all, I do not want to discount where my fellow supervisors are with this, but in my mind, it does taking something out of production, managed for something different, it's not a for-profit operation, takes the pressure off the existing landowners that are trying to run a business, so be it. Supervisor Gobstuff, you know, I hear what you're saying when it comes to the Nature Conservancy. I've had the opposite. Everyone's, you know, my district looks at it as a slightly different view. They support that. And as you know, we all know, we represent constituents. You know, again, to me, it's why are we talking about this now? Why wasn't there a lead up to this whole process so we could have had a conversation and agenda before? Again, I'm working off an agenda sheet item that had no background. So So that's where I am with it. And let's just go ahead and call for the vote.
But it just landed on basically our desk, what, 2 weeks ago, that this was even going to take place.
Correct.
And again, I would have waited for on an opposition letter. I would have had them come before. Let's have a discussion. Let's do some fact finding, that kind of thing. You know, I totally get. I'm not really nearly about the state, particularly with the drought declaration. When I'm seeing snow up on the top of Mount Shasta type thing and the water flows there. But having said that, you know, I don't want to pin all that, the blame on that where it should go, on the Nature Conservancy.
I don't discount what you're saying. I've had a great working relationship with Nature Conservancy, have stood ground in my constituency that was against the
sure.
purchase. So, and yet we were able to build a bridge to
sure.
that gap. But like I say, there has been no regulatory relief to these systems for all of the good that's supposedly going in to the purchase of these properties. And we can't afford, Nature's Conservancy is not going to own this for ever. And
but the state will own the water forever.
Well, if it's turned over to the state, like it was at Big Springs. But again, the state put 17 and a half CFS of water off the landscape in Big Springs Ranch. Did nothing to the regulatory environment. Management plan, I know Mr. Harris, he's only had it for a little while, and I appreciate, you know, what he's been doing to try to get it off the ground, but former Supervisor Bennett and I were first started out when that land purchase happened for a management plan to co-manage with the county. And since that time, the management plan has not come out yet, and the co-management was taken away from the county and given to the tribes, which the tribes have a great project going on out there, which is a form of IDAG injection, but the department has not been able to fulfill giving them eggs to bear out again a supplementation program that we all support. So this is a tough spot, and can good work happen?
Sure.
But tax revenue future for the county
yeah.
is where I'm looking at, and that's where I'm concerned.
And I'm not discounting that. To me, it's just not black and white. There's just more to this than just straight, what's in front of us, so to speak. And I would like to think we're starting to turn the corner. The dams are out. Supposedly the salmon are running up there. Hopefully we have a good water year. I mean, which we need, right? I mean, across the board.
Well, we have an audience for this, so we might as well talk about it. It's interesting because our former deputy, Elizabeth
Nielsen,
on a tour up recently at Keno, they were obviously talking about salmon restoration and that, and lo and behold, unbeknownst to anyone, because the state of Oregon and Bureau of Reclamation has no monitoring equipment in place for salmon returning to that region, but 30 trapped spawners were at the bottom of Keno that had to be captured and moved over the dam because they had not prepared that fish passage there for salmon. Over all of these years that we've been dealing with dam removal, nothing on the Oregon side was prepared for the receiving of these fish, and yet they're there. So it tells you somebody, the state, which state, whichever, and I know that California doesn't have anything to do with that, but or the feds, the ball is dropped for all of the good things that they tell us is going to happen. Nobody's monitoring these fish. So, again, I want to see relief to the systems that have given up so much in the Shasta and the Scott to bear out all of this fish recovery, and I'm not seeing that evidence yet.
So, Mr. Harris? Let's call for a vote.
Ready, Supervisor Valenzuela?
No.
Supervisor Help?
Yes.
Supervisor Harris?
Aye.
Supervisor Cobsa?
Aye.
And Supervisor Oberyn?
Aye.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to item 6, discussion and possible direction for CSAC to discuss with us the options regarding charter county.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess while we're getting the presentation set up, I'll go ahead and introduce myself. My name is Eric Lawyer. I'm a legislative advocate for the California State Association of Counties. I'm here today to talk about county charters, but as part of this conversation, I'm going to talk about what charters often look like, the state constitution, some case law over the past 100 years or more, and some recent examples of charter amendments that have been done and attempted throughout the state. Before I begin, I want to thank this Board of Supervisors for inviting me here today, and for your staff, Natalie, Book of the Board, and everybody who's made this pretty easy. So, also, one quick moment of privilege, just want to say how incredible it is to be not just in front of this board, but in this county. I spent a lot of my childhood here in Siskiyou County, visiting my grandparents in Mount Shasta, and my cousins in Sweetbriar, and it's among the most beautiful parts of the state, so great to be here. Next slide, please. So, very quickly, the California State Association of Counties, we are a nonprofit association composed of and governed by all 58 counties in the state. Just a few years ago, county supervisors elected Supervisor Valenzuela to serve as president for our organization. We were founded in 1894, so it's been a little over 130 years, and our principal purpose is to speak as the unified voice of all 58 counties in our state in front of the legislature, state agencies, and the federal government. We also provide educational opportunities for supervisors and staff, as well as leadership, and some direct county services. Next slide, please. So I'll begin with the most simple question, which is, you know, what is a county charter? You can really think of it as governing provisions for a county. These are often alternatives or supplements to county ordinances. They're published in state statutes and have the effect of a state statute. They require voter approval to adopt or amend. So anytime you want to become a charter county or make any changes to it at all, it requires approval by the voters. They do provide counties some additional flexibility to supersede inconsistent state law on issues of governance, including filling a board vacancy, expanding the board of supervisors, some alternative election methods, but there could be questions around the Voting Rights Act and what is actually allowable or not, and making some positions elected versus appointed. Next slide, please. So I'm going to start by walking through some sections of the state constitution, starting with Article 11, Section 1. Article 11 speaks generally to the powers of local governments with respect to the state. Section 1 begins that the state is divided into counties, which are legal subdivisions of the state. And then it goes on to say that the legislature shall provide for county powers, among other provisions. I'll come back to this in a little bit. I skipped Article 2, or Section 2, because it speaks just to cities. But I'll talk about Section 3, which actually is the first section regarding adoption of a charter for both counties and cities. This section provides the power for either county or city to adopt a charter and effectively declares that charters may include provisions that can be inconsistent with state law. Charters can be proposed either by the Board of Supervisors or by through a charter commission. That includes both the principal adoption of a charter or any amendments to it. After that, changes can also be made through what's known as a charter commission, where 15 members of the community are elected to serve, and they function effectively as a body that can consider changes to a charter. But effectively, through initiative or through board vote, changes to a charter can be proposed to voters, but everything requires enactment by the voters themselves. Next slide, please. So, you know, in my last slide, I was covering some language that provides that some sections of a charter can effectively supersede inconsistent state law, but I want to begin by noting a couple of foundational court cases that largely constrain what those inconsistencies can look like. Starting with Wilkinson v. Lund in 1929, There is a couple critical takeaways from this court case, starting with, you know, this quote, which is effectively that only provisions of a charter that are effectively authorized by the Constitution itself may supersede that law. So effectively what that's saying is that charters can only be inconsistent with state law where the Constitution itself kind of gives that authority. This finding was backed up a couple of decades later in a subsequent court case, Byers v. Board of Supervisors. This case looked at an initiative in the required charter amendment in San Bernardino County, where the county established an authority to effectively provide television broadcasting services. A member of the community challenged that, effectively said it was not within the rights of the county to do that. And what the court case determined was that was not consistent with the constitutional powers provided through the Constitution, even in granting that to a charter county. Also wanted to come back to Wilkinson v. Lund by talking about another finding of that court. So what that case was evaluating was the tax measure passed through a charter initiative in Butte County in the 1920s. What that case did, or what the charter amendment did, was dramatically reduce property taxes to a level where they were effectively challenged on whether that was constitutional or not. And what the court found was that provision so limited revenue that the county was incapable of providing state-required services, including law enforcement, managing the roads, and other, you know, critical services that the state effectively is assigned to counties. Next slide, please. So, you know, just talking about some of the limits of charters that have been, you know, kind of established through both the Constitution and court findings, but I also want to speak about some of the powers. So, this was a case in the 1990s where the County of San Diego established a citizens commission and gave it some subpoena powers. That was challenged, and what that court found is they actually ruled in favor of the charter amendment, declaring that that was an allowable use of charter power because it pertains specifically to the actual structure and operation of the government itself. I'm including that to kind of show that, you know, county powers of the charter are effectively constrained by not being able to do something that is required of a county by the state through constitution or even through statute. Where that power clearly lies is in the ability to determine how the government itself may operate. There's, you know, some nuance and complication of that that I'll talk about a little bit later in the presentation, but I think that's kind of a clean way to look at the differences and what is allowable through a charter, which is making determinations on governance versus whether or not you can comply with and follow state law. Next slide, please. So Article 11, Section 4 actually kind of gets a bit more specific as to what must be in a charter, what should be in a charter, and where those powers lie. And again, that comes down to governance. So it actually lays out and uses some pretty declarative language saying that a charter shall include, you know, you cannot have fewer than five supervisors, but you can, through a charter, elect to have more. You must always have an elected sheriff. That's a constitutional requirement. You must always have an elected DA and assessor. But the charter itself shall provide for which positions are elected, which are appointed, which are consolidated, and which powers are segregated. In addition to that, the charter shall provide for compensation, terms, and removal of office, performance of those functions, and kind of a litany of other provisions. So up until the early 2000s, this section was effectively read to require that a charter speak to all of those different provisions. But that was actually challenged through a court case in 2002. Next slide, please. So Orange County in 2002 adopted a charter, and they effectively tested that assumption. And what that charter did, it was very short, it was just a few sentences, and basically declared that they were invoking their right as a charter county to make decisions about how they will fill vacancies on their board. That was the only section and provision included in that charter. It did not speak to how many members of the Board of Supervisors, their compensation, their term limits, any of that. It just spoke to one issue. And that was challenged in the courts. as a potential violation of Section 4. But what that court found was that despite the fact that the language in Section 4 says a charter shall include these provisions, if a charter lacks them, then effectively the county just defaults to what's called general law, which I think is a fairly common sense kind of reading of that. You know, if you don't speak to it, then general law applies, either through statute or constitution. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the differences between cities and counties just for a moment. And this is really to highlight where, again, some of those restrictions and limitations lie with respect to counties and charter counties, even compared to our cities. So Article 11, Section 5 speaks to the power for charter cities to adopt, through their charter, ordinances and regulations that are inconsistent with state law and declares them to have municipal power over municipal affairs. Section 7 speaks to counties and cities and basically declares that they also have police power, sanitary power, and other ordinances and regulations that are inconsistent with law. Municipal affairs has been interpreted by the courts and through the legislature to be even broader than those powers given to counties. Effectively, municipal affairs doctrine states that if it's not a matter of statewide concern, then you can, through a city charter, adopt ordinances that are inconsistent with the state. Counties have lacked that power since the Constitution has been around. So I'll go ahead and move to the next slide. And what a matter of statewide concern effectively is you know, it's kind of in the words themselves, is that it's an issue that is so important to the state that it kind of rises above issues of local control, even for a charter city or a charter county. That can include, you know, something like law enforcement regulations, you know, roads and streets, environmental laws, all types of things I'll cover in a little bit. But there's often a question between implied preemption under this this doctrine of an issue being a matter of statewide concern. Typically, the courts will decide that. And often, and more often, I'd add, statutes themselves will include specific language declaring something to be a matter of statewide concern. And that is a direct attempt by the legislature to kind of avoid any question of whether or not an issue applies to charter cities or even charter counties, passing a law that just declares right off the bat that this is a matter of statewide concern, which means that if you're a charter city or a charter county, you don't have additional powers compared to general law cities or counties. Next slide, please. So I want to come back to that. So I was just kind of talking about the differences between some additional powers that cities have versus counties. And the reason why is we come back to Article 11, Section 1. You know, it states that the state is divided into counties, which are legal subdivisions. So if you're looking at the question of whether or not an issue is a matter of statewide concern, counties are already, you know, kind of have a harder case to make that it is not an issue of statewide concern, because the state is effectively divided into counties. You know, every square inch of the state, every person that lives in the state lives in a county. That's not true for cities. And as we know, too, that the state has, for decades since it's existed, you know, delegated a lot of its powers and authorities directly to counties. So, you know, typically for a county, even compared to a city, it can be more difficult to prove that something is not inherently a matter of statewide concern. So I've listed some of these, you know, municipal powers, some of which, you know, counties actually can rule on and be inconsistent with through their charter, but some of the additional powers that even charter cities have that counties don't is some additional revenue sources, like going above and beyond the statutory minimum for property transfer tax. Both cities and counties actually do have some additional powers and the types of elections that they conduct, not in the administration of it, but in the actual representation. And that existed up until the 1960s when the Voting Rights Act passed. But up until then, a charter city or charter county could have, you know, at-large elections. That was something that was a clear additional power that was provided through a charter. Again, federal law has made that those powers effectively moot, from my understanding. But that is some additional flexibility that at least up until then existed for cities and counties. Some clear powers that exist for both charter cities and counties are some additional referendum recall procedures or removal of certain individuals from office, compensation of city officers and employees, and historically at least, city contracting, not for counties, but largely cities, benefited from some additional flexibility in contracting law, some labor laws, and some land use and zoning. But I put historically because those have been kind of whittled away through recent legislation over the past few decades. Some traditional matters of statewide concern include traffic and vehicle regulation, educational policies, open meeting laws, eminent domain, tort claims, or even local agency investments, which was a specific effort by the state legislature after some bankruptcies or near bankruptcies at the local level to actually tighten that up. Next slide, please. So again, I talked a little bit about municipal powers. Counties do enjoy police and sanitary powers, which does empower counties, especially through a charter, to make and enforce any laws, ordinances that are not in conflict with general laws that are necessary for the protection and well-being of your residents. Next slide, please. So I've kind of been talking at a higher conceptual level, and I just wanted to show the very clear differences between a general law county and a charter county, based on what has been proven and survived court challenges. So at the very top, filling a board vacancy is something that we know that a charter county has quite a bit more power and local control in how they determine to fill a board vacancy. So if you're a general law county, which Siskiyou County is, and there's a vacancy on the board, that position is appointed by the governor. The local board does not have that power authority to appoint or set up the procedure for how that position will be appointed. It's appointed by the governor and if it remains open until the next election, then it's filled through the election. Through a charter, you can decide, if you want to empower the board of supervisors to fill that appointment. You can, through the charter, determine, based on when a vacancy occurs, if you just leave it open until the next election. Those are powers that are given to charter counties through how you draft and adopt that charter. I mentioned this earlier, but as a general law county, you're limited to just five county supervisors. If you become a charter county, you can actually choose to expand the board. Certain positions can become elected through a charter, including the county administrator or county CEO. And then I talked about this a little bit ago, but at least up until passage of the Voting Rights Act, there was some leeway in how elections are conducted versus district-based versus at-large. Next slide, please. So I have here just a map of all the charter counties in the state. You'll see there's 15 charter counties, 43 general law. You can see that there's quite a bit of geographic representation, and even at a population level, quite a bit of diversity. Next slide, please. This slide shows which counties are charter counties and when. You'll notice that for the most part, the counties that have adopted a charter did so in the 1930s. It's actually kind of an interesting question as to why that's the case. I mean, I've heard a lot of different hypotheses, one of which is that counties actually were given some additional statutory discretion over the past few decades. I'm sure it doesn't feel that way, but at least in terms of the issues of governance, that was provided through some statutory changes over the years to, consolidate certain positions, segregate duties, make some positions appointed versus elected, and vice versa. And then you'll see, too, the most recent county that became a charter was Shasta, which just technically a few weeks ago formally became a charter county. Next slide, please. I just mentioned this, but statute does still provide general law counties some power to make certain positions elective versus appointed if voters approve via local initiative. You don't need a charter to do this. But I put asterisk next to sheriff, DA, and assessor, which by requirements in the Constitution are always elected. So I'm going to talk through a few recent examples of how charters have been amended. Starting with LA County, which their voters just elected to do this last fall. They voted to expand the Board of Supervisors from 5 to 9 members. They will become the only county outside of the city and county of San Francisco, which is a little bit unique, and actually choosing to expand their board. They also elected to make their county CEO an elected position. So in 2028, that seat will become available. The board won't expand until 2032. There's also some ethics reform included in that provision. I think perhaps, you know, I don't want to refer to it as a cautionary tale, but, you know, there's a few examples of kind of the administrative complexity at times with charter amendments and just charters in general. LA County accidentally perhaps repealed a 2020 charter amendment, Measure J, because something either wasn't filed or presented to voters with that new language, so voters effectively, without meaning to or without the board meaning to do this, revoked a charter amendment that had just been passed 4 years earlier. So I think it's kind of a novel legal question on whether or not that charter language remains in effect or not, which I think is still being resolved. So next slide, please. Another recent example was Shasta County, which passed Measure D in 2024. That made them the latest county to adopt a charter. That charter was specific just to filling a vacancy on their board. You know, again, speaking to perhaps the administrative complexity with this, is there was an actual missed opportunity to certify and formally transmit that charter to the Secretary of State, which is a required action with the charter. Because remember, these have the effect of state statute, so there's a formal administrative process where the Secretary of State actually ratifies a charter, adds it to statutes. Somehow that was missed until August of this year, after which the county formally submitted that and formally became a charter county in September this year. Another, I think, interesting perhaps test case of charter powers and authorities just happened in Fresno County. So a few years ago, AB 759 was passed by the state legislature, which moved the election of sheriff and DA from the gubernatorial cycle to the presidential cycle. And what the law said is counties that already have in their charter when those positions are elected, they're effectively grandfathered in. In Fresno County, they voted to actually adopt brand new charter language. They didn't speak to when those positions were elected previously. Their voters passed that through Measure A, which effectively flouted the law and said, you know, we're choosing to keep our elections for DA and sheriff on the gubernatorial cycle and kind of ignore this law, effectively declaring that, you know, this is not state's turf. This is the rights of a charter county to make these decisions. These are about self-governance. It was challenged by the Attorney General and Secretary of State and was just invalidated by a court ruling in June. The court effectively declared that that was not a charter power to ignore the law. So, next slide, please. Another recent example was San Mateo County, which earlier this year passed Measure A. In response to some allegations against their sheriff, they actually passed a charter amendment that gave the board the power to remove their sheriff through a four-fifths vote. It only granted them those powers until 2028, and it required a series of procedural votes, which they've been conducting over the last few months. Just last week, they did the last vote to formally remove the sheriff from office. I don't want to speculate, but I'd imagine that this is something that perhaps could get challenged as whether or not, you know, to have a court look at if this is a county power or not to begin with. But to my knowledge, the only example of this ever happening in our state. Next slide, please. And then San Bernardino County, which has passed several charter amendments the last few years. Starting with Measure K in 2020, which I think in perhaps in response to some frustrations with county's response to, you know, the COVID pandemic, there was voters approved charter amendments that limited their Board of Supervisors to a single term of office of 4 years and limited their compensation to $60,000 a year. That was reversed just a couple of years later through Measure D. Then Measure L was passed in 2024 that ties the compensation of certain county officers, mostly in law enforcement, to those of neighboring counties. counties as an attempt to effectively raise pay and establish minimum funding amounts for county law enforcement. Next slide, please. And then another, I think, kind of fascinating example of, you know, perhaps some of the factors to consider with charters is Tehama County, which several decades ago, a long time ago, passed a charter amendment that limits the compensation of the Board of Supervisors to $1,045 a month with a pretty tiny inflation factor. Because it's in their charter, it requires approval by their voters to actually change that. And I think there's been a few attempts over the years to do that. It hasn't happened. So effectively, their Board of Supervisors make sub-minimum wage and are the lowest paid employees in that county because of what is memorialized in the charter. I'll end on just a quick procedural note. I think I mostly covered this earlier, but there's a couple of ways for a charter to both take effect or to be amended. That's through either the Board of Supervisors to propose a charter adoption or amendment, or through local initiative. And then voters, of course, have the final say on whether or not a charter is adopted or amended. Next slide. And then this slide just provides a little bit more information on the process itself, including the establishment of a charter commission. But I think I'll go ahead and end there and open it up for any questions.
So if the county became a charter on one issue, everything else in the county remained the same under general law, even administrative processes?
Yes, that's correct. So that was what the court determined in 2002 in Orange County when they did the exact thing.
Okay, and I'm still a little confused on the contradictory law piece. Inconsistent laws? I mean, my God, we deal with inconsistent law constantly. I'm really struggling with why some of our inconsistencies locally somehow are interpreted as statewide. Where are the lines?
So it's a great question, and typically you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis, but I think we're a way to look at where the lines are generally. Mm-hmm. The areas that we know a charter county can be inconsistent with state law is more so in the space of governance and how you choose to govern yourselves. You know, how many supervisors you have, who is elected, whether or not you want your CEO to be elected, how you fill vacancies on your own board. On the other hand, there's been a few attempts to use charters to kind of ignore or be inconsistent with state law, and courts have consistently over the past 100 years plus declared that if a matter is of statewide concern, that a charter, you cannot adopt a charter amendment that allows you to not comply with that law. So if it's something that has to do with practices in a county or delivery of services or compliance with, you know, any state law outside of governance, for the most part, courts have found that to not be within the powers of a charter county. As legal subdivisions of the state, counties are effectively required to follow what those statutes are, unless they're pertaining really to how you govern yourself.
I guess maybe I'll draw this back into a little more specific. We deal with all kinds of water issues, and state frequently passes general language in regulation, but contradicts a lot of things locally. I'll use AB 263 specifically, recently passed, violates adjudications. It seems inconsistent to me. Would a charter county have any authority to do something about that?
You know? You know, I'm a little bit wary to speak on specifics, but I think by and large, something like, you know, water issues, environmental issues in general, those have you know, almost every instance been seen as an issue of statewide concern that, you know, regardless of the, you know, the wisdom of the legislature and governor in passing some of these laws, you know, counties are required to comply with them. And would be my hunch that a charter would not allow you to say that those laws aren't consistent with how we choose to govern ourselves. The state, and likely the courts, would say that, you know, these are issues of statewide concern. Whether or not that's explicitly stated in the law, counties are typically, you know, required to comply with those, despite whatever impacts they might be having in their community, unfortunately. Okay.
Another specific, pardon me, one that really sticks in my craw is we own a power generation facility, Sister County, with a hydro dam, yet the California State Constitution prohibits us from strong interactions with CPUC. That to me is very inconsistent because we have to negotiate rates. Is there any relief in the charter authority for us to have a more direct relationship with the CPUC through a charter because of the statewide article that's in the state constitution?
You know, it's a great question. I'll admit I'm not aware of case law looking at that specific question. I think I would like to defer that to counsel, perhaps for future research to see if that question or even something similar to that has been evaluated in the past.
Mm-hmm. The reason I bring it up is we're kind of, you know, tossed to the wind in the fact that, you know, we're barely making operational costs with what we're being reimbursed through the CPUC's regulation, and to not be able to directly go after that as a county just seems irresponsible to me. I'll yield.
Okay. Any other questions?
I've researched this quite a bit.
If a city decided to become a charter city, how does that affect, and we didn't as a county, how does that affect our relationship when it comes to tax sharing agreements and boundary line adjustments and those sorts of kind of LAFCO type interactions?
You know, that's an excellent question. You know, I think I want to defer to Natalie on this one to look at a little bit deeper. But I'm not aware of, you know, any existing examples of charter city authority that allows them to go above and beyond what a city can already do with respect to their relationship with the county. It's more so about how the city governs itself, less so about, you know, kind of stepping on the toes of the county or interfering with LAFCO. That's kind of my hunch, but I think I would prefer to have, you know, perhaps council look a little bit deeper into that question.
So their charter really is more about how they run their own business and not, it's more about personnel and that kind of latitude, not so much about infrastructure. And it worries me when we start talking about sanitation and roads and things like that, because that kind of bleeds into what we do. And those boundaries are very hard to separate.
And I think kind of the point you might be making too is that something like that is likely to be seen as a matter of statewide concern.
Yes.
Because it's something that bleeds out of not just that city's boundaries,
right,
into neighboring counties,
yes,
neighboring cities, the state in general. So again, that is that test of the municipal affairs doctrine, is whether or not something is of statewide concern, and not about specifically what happens within the confines of that city.
Yep.
So how the city chooses to, you know, elect their body, certain revenue options that frankly cities have that counties don't, those don't extend out of the city itself. They're all contained within the city and are not matters of statewide concern.
Well,
so again, I think that's
right, and that city is within the county.
Yes.
So there's always that we try to cooperate. We always try to cooperate, but sometimes we have those relationships that don't always work. Even now, we try very hard to have a really good relationship, but sometimes there are issues that come up that we have to really, you know, work at and negotiate. And I think when those kind of things, whether it's us going toward charter or the city, any city that would consider that, I have a little bit of angst over how those things would work in a cooperative manner. And I just wonder, if it's just personnel and those sorts of issues, I get it. Same with us. I just wonder how those relationships work in other places.
Yeah, it really does, you know, depend on the specifics. But, you know, again, just to kind of underscore the point of, you know, even for a charter city, they're effectively confined to, you know, making decisions about their own governance. And if something extends out to something being a matter of statewide concern, you know, sanitation, environmental control, sharing of those revenues, that's something that extends out of the boundaries of that city. And I have to imagine they would not be seen as a municipal affair, meaning that they could not be inconsistent just by virtue of being a charter city.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I got one more. Can we explore police powers a little more? I'm always it's not amazed, disappointed, I guess is more the choice of words here, that when under our county code enforcement, we seem to be always tied to infractions that are quite frankly a joke as far as fines for some things. We're also confined to like environmental hazards have to be tied specifically to a land issue for us rather than the act itself. Is there any change in that with the charter county?
You know, I'm not aware of charters that have, you know, done additional, given the county additional flexibility with regards to code enforcement. It's such a complicated area, and I think we probably have to look at individual laws and see if either there's been the express, you know, language noting that it's a matter of statewide concern, or if there's case law. But I think that'd be, again, I feel like assigning Natalie a lot of homework, but could be another good issue to continue to research.
You can tell I'm more interested in the positive differences than I am, you know, just telling me what a charter county is. That's ever present on my mind, the things that we confront daily here and how can we resolve some of these things. And if the charter county is a vehicle to do that, then so be it. If that's not it, I want to know what other avenues we could pursue on some of these things.
Okay. Does that satisfy everybody?
No.
Today?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Take a break.
Sure. Take a break.
We can. Yeah,
we can. We'll be back in 10 minutes.